The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lincolnell Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee.
Brought to you in part by the Greater Haines Chamber of Commerce, a membership organization promoting sustainable economic growth and community development through advocacy, facilitation, and education. Learn more about the Chamber at haineschamber.org.
And welcome to Talk Around Town, your community radio's attempt to put issues in context. I'm Deborah Schnabel, today's program host. Tom Morfitt, the editor of the Chilkat Valley News, is back with us today to give us perspective on current events. Emily Files is checking in with Alaska Arts Confluence. And our talking topic today is management of state forests with Roy Josephson and Greg Palmieri. Stay tuned. And a good morning to you, Tom Morfitt.
Good morning, Deborah.
How are you?
Sleepy, and I'm just kind of curious today to see if our big ski event's going to happen.
Absolutely. We've been waiting for this for months.
And for days now.
It has been a vigil, I think.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're talking, of course, about the Free Ride World Tour.
Free Ride World Tour, which, you know, wisely purchased a 10-day window, 10-day permit, secured a 10-day permit to get their Bluebird Day. And Tourism Director Leslie Ross very confident yesterday that it would be a Bluebird Day. They've narrowed down their filming site to a spot near 40 Mile where there's a little – there are more Bluebird Days than here in town. I think they initially wanted that shot just across the inlet.
They call it Haskell Bowl.
Haskell Bowl, where you have the ocean backdrop that skiers rarely see.
Oh, is that the point?
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
part of
that's
it. Oh, that's
the full, you know, the Chilkat Mountains on the opposite side and the inlet is
because
a money
the other
shot.
Events in this series have taken place in the Alps, right? In France,
inland,
and Switzerland.
Inland locations, which are typically where ski resorts are located. Where there's reliably clear skies.
So
I wanted to talk a little bit about that, and that's that how the weather kind of factors in to our economy and these kind of events. And people here that were here in 1991 remember that White Fang, which was the last and probably will be the only feature-length film ever made in this town, is my prediction.
Because of the weather.
Well, partly because of the weather. Budgeted for about $6 million. It cost more than twice that to make. For days, the planes were on the ground. They had to fly out their dailies, which were their shoots.
Oh,
their
film.
Had not experienced that before, where you have to wait a week to get your dailies. It's called daily because it goes out every day.
But now they do it electronically.
Well, yeah. I guess that's how they're doing it. But, you know, back in the days when. And this kind of weather economics, we just think, oh, that's just the weather. But I submit that we don't do a very good job of considering it in our
management.
Well,
if we told everybody, then nothing would happen at all.
Well, in terms of the promotion, sure.
My goodness,
you always have to put a blue sky photo in your visitor's guide. I understand that. But, I mean, as a person who crosses their fingers every Thursday for clear weather so his newspaper can show up here.
Yeah.
I understand this implicitly, and I submit that our government, our community, doesn't think about it that much.
But what can we do about it,
Well, we do things about it all the time to a certain extent. We put a roof over our outdoor basketball court because we figure when the kids are out there playing basketball, it's going to be raining a lot. Well, now with our climate change, where the models are everybody's going to get the weather from in the northern hemisphere from a couple hundred miles south. What does that mean? And I wrote an editorial in November, and I said, okay, folks, this is going to predicted to be a warm, wet winter, one of those yucky ones where there's not mm-hmm. really much skiing or skating. Maybe we should, open different public facilities, gyms, libraries, a little bit more, create more things, more opportunities, because it's not going to be real pleasant outside. And there's an economic, the economic response is we don't have money for that. And I submit, what's the economic cost of families going to Mexico for a couple months? Balance mm-hmm. versus that. And also, Haines has always touted itself as one of the sunniest spots in the rainforest.
We
in the
have the banana rainforest. Belt, we right, are, as Jack Martin used to call us.
And that's paid off with people, during the housing boom in the early 2000s, we had, five or six or how many vacation homes sticklers were running around building. I mean, will that happen if our climate becomes Ketchikan? Are people going to want to, did people like me move here, to live in a Ketchikan? I think the weather plays my overall part here is that the weather plays a much bigger
part in our economy,
than we really take into account. And I think we should take it into account. And my final thing I would say on that is Klukwan, where the people that were here for 8,000 years found the driest, most windless, sunniest spot in the valley. And they said, we're putting our town here.
It's the confluence of three rivers and all the rest
where
of it.
Where the fish
stuff.
Come in.
But, they are impacted also. I mean, everybody is impacted by the weather change,
sure.
But still.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I did see a man, a local man, in a pair of thongs and Bermuda shorts yesterday at the grocery store. And he was obviously in reaction to the warmer weather.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Free Ride World Tour. So I mm-hmm. think that it's supposed to happen. It was supposed to happen starting 15 minutes ago, but I have been hot off. Here we are, and the media has informed me that they have put a 15-minute delay.
Right.
We're down to the 15 minutes. It used to be right. week by week and then day by day, and now we're down to hour by hour and 15 and quarters of hours.
Yeah, and they've wanted to decide this thing the day before, which I guess apparently is needed for the lead time mm-hmm. for the logistics.
Mm-hmm.
They might be left with doing what people in Haines do, which is we'll see how the weather is when we wake up.
right. Well, anyway, it's interesting because the other two things that I think were happening this week that were really interesting was the premiere of two shows that television programs that have featured Haines people. One of them is called Buying Alaska, mm-hmm. and that's where people go around to houses that are on the market and look at them. With the potential for buying them, and Building Alaska, and that's where our local Tony Malone with Dark Horse Construction is being featured as a man who rehabilitates falling down cabins in the wilderness. I guess that's what he told me he was mm-hmm. doing. But I mean, so right here in Haines, in this 1 week, those three things: Free Ride, Buying, and Building Alaska.
So and it will be interesting cool. to see for the reality shows what happens. The State Film Office, which gives a very generous film credit to people making those shows and films here, this few weeks ago has suspended that credit. And that apparently has affected a decision to not make or prompted a decision to not film a feature-length film in Whittier was planned. And we get a lot of exposure from those shows. Alaska is very hot right now. The wisdom of removing that credit, we'll see.
Well, I've always heard that the that department did not make money. In fact, cost. I once saw an economic study on that whole issue of the credit for filming in Alaska, and it did not pay off. But anyway,
right. And things can change. Unknown is what is the publicity worth?
Right.
Yeah.
Anything else before we sign off? And thank you for being with us today.
I want to give a plug to the Northern Light Showcase, all local talent. Sunday night.
Okay. And we'll mark that down.
There's going to be a horn section. Right. I encourage people to come out.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks, Deb.
As always, a new perspective on events in Haines. Thanks for being with us. Alaska Arts Confluence is a nonprofit organization focused on creating community through support of artists and their work. They brought us art on Main Street. Today, Haynes's KHNS's Emily Files is checking in with Executive Director Carol Tyneman and the project manager Reese Williams about a really inventive sculpture garden that's planned for Fort Seward.
I'm Carol Tyneman. I'm the Creative Director of Alaska Arts Confluence.
And I'm Reese Williams. I'm the project manager of the Fort Seward Interpretive Project.
So what is the mission of the Alaska Arts Confluence?
Alaska Arts Confluence was formed to promote all artists of the Chilkat Valley, and through education, enrichment, and other projects for visitors and residents alike.
And how did the Fort Seward project idea come about?
Well, when Tanya Carlson was the tourism director, she was putting out the word that she was looking for a way to redo the interpretive signs in Fort Seward. Right now there's 6 of them. And I found out through Peter Gall that there was an Art Place America grant available for creative placemaking. So I proposed that we would submit that. And we did end up getting the Art Place America grant of $217,000. So that made it possible to do this project.
And can you explain what is it? It's an interpretive art project?
Okay. Rather than just going around and reading about the history of a location, the historic Fort Seward Interpretive Project will tie the past and the present together through the eyes of our creative community. So through the artists' sculptures and art pieces, they will get a broader vision of the history of Fort Seward as it applies today.
This could be for either of you, but could you describe what it looks like right now, and what you're hoping, what your vision is for what it'll look like when this project is completed?
Well, the initial impression when you walk up Totem Street, you see the burned out, I believe it's E Barracks building, that's burned in the 80s sometime and was pretty much left as a ruin. It's interesting and sort of tragic and historical. And the idea amongst the developed and evolved amongst the artists to maintain its integrity as a ruin, as a historical site, and yet put these interpretive art projects into that location that'll tie in, again, as Carol said, the past and the present and the vision for the future of the fort and that particular building.
Right. There's 17 artists involved in 16 commissions. Some of the artists are working together. It's a collaborative project, and it was their vision to make the ruins into a destination. And it's really exciting because since finding out, looking into other interpretive gardens, and there will be a garden involved, an ethnobotanical garden, over time will be developed.
What does that mean, ethnobotanical?
It's another kind of walking tour where you get to learn about the history of plants and how they were used in this particular location. So it's also an interpretive project through botanical installations. Yeah.
So the Haynes artists that are going to be participating in this, could you describe a couple of their project ideas and how they kind of fit in with the theme of the garden?
Well, Andrea Nelson, who is the artistic director for the project, is doing a stratigraphy installation, which is an archaeological recapitulation of found objects that define what went on in the fort over a period of time. So she's actually making an installation along a wall about 20 feet long, that will be layers of found objects from the ruins. So that's an interpretive piece of the history. Carrie Cohen is doing a ceramics installation, which comes out of a project where she's developed how to make glacial and ice breakups so that the ceramic will actually look like the ice. Jim Heaton is designing a welcoming figure, and that's what's going to be high up on the wall, and people will be able to see that from the cruise ship dock, and that's a traditional Tlingit welcoming figure that makes people feel welcome from coming off the water into the community or from various byways. Bob Goldberg has proposed a collaboration with Wayne Price of a Tlingit bracelet that will be gigantic enough so people to go inside and sit down, and it'll be look exactly like a silver bracelet. So that ties in with the art history of the development of AIA at the fort, where artists were brought back into their culture to promote Tlingit design, jewelry making, carving, dance, and things like that that were at risk of being lost because of cultural oppression.
Is this project, the scale of this project, it seems pretty big with that many artists and in a pretty large space. How does this compare to other kind of, have there been other projects in Haines like this before?
No, it's just a tremendously huge project, but it's coming together beautifully because of everyone's engagement.
Yeah, have there ever been this many local artists commissioned for one local project?
No. In fact, even in a large city, normally one or two artists gets commissioned to do a project. But I think it's going to be pulled off.
Yeah, why have you guys chosen to have this many artists involved?
Well, the purpose of the Art Place America grant is to put art at the center of the community. That's create another aspect of community creative placemaking. So they gave us the mandate by funding this project to involve as many artists as we can. So for example, we have the Art on Main Street, which is involving 40 artists and artisans in window displays. So our goal is over time for every artist and artisan to be showcased in some fashion.
So as project manager, what are some of the things that you are doing right now to get ready for this?
Wow. there's a lot of site prep. We're planning. We're coordinating with the borough on how they can help us out, and they've been wonderfully helpful and supportive of this whole thing. Coordinating the various artists. We're still in the early stages at this point, and the weather's kind of is a factor, so some artists are prepping. I'm assembling tools and future work dates and that kind of thing as we begin to gain momentum here. And I made myself available to all of the artists for any kind of questions they may have on installations and that type of thing. The technical aspect of it is what I'm helping out with.
Are you an artist?
I am an artist. I've been a glass blower, a traditional glass blower for 40 years or so. I'm a professor. I've taught glass making and glass art history in various colleges and universities around the country, and I had a working studio for 40 years. I'm changing sort of out of my media a bit at the moment. I've been doing some carving and painting lately.
And you've been in Haines for a while?
Just a couple of years at the most here. I came up a year or so ago, a little over a year ago, to help some friends move into town, and loved it so much and stayed because of the wonderful art community and the support, and it's a great place.
So how does it make you feel to see a project of this scale that has this many artists involved and is going to be a kind of public space?
I think it's one of the most amazing things I've seen in my history of teaching art and being connected with art, to see a community come together like this and support the artists and have the artists enthusiastic and totally willing to contribute to their community in such a heavy way. I can't even think of any project like this in the country that brings so many artists together for public work in such a public place. It's going to benefit everybody.
And how are you feeling about it at this stage of things?
Oh, I'm always excited. I love doing things that make people happy. So, but what you're saying, that made me think of one thing I wanted to mention, that we're making every effort we can to invest this grant completely in our community, and that we're hiring artists and artisans to do other aspects, such as creating the spaces for the window displays, you know, carpentry, stonemasonry. There's all kinds of
builders.
Yeah, all kinds of parts of the project that require some kind of creative input, which I think is a great model for our whole community, because really everything we do is creative as human beings, and we want to make our community as beautiful as a built environment as it is in the natural environment.
So I'm not really familiar with the fort barracks. Is this an indoor project or outdoor project?
It's outdoor.
It's outdoor. So what kind of challenge does that present for the different pieces of art?
A lot. In fact, we need to go get ready for a presentation that Helen Alton, the director of the museum, today. She's going to be talking about how the elements affect sculpture and installation materials, and the artists are coming to that to learn things that they may or may not know already about how to make their pieces stand up to the elements. And there are a lot of considerations, but one of the things that we've asked the artists to do is to build the concept of deterioration into their piece so that it works, that becomes part of the total environment.
Wow, what an interesting thing to consider.
Well, that's the way life is, you know? Yeah. We're born, we mature, and then we deteriorate.
Anything else that you guys want to add about the Fort Seward project?
Not really, except how enthused I am about the whole thing and how I think it's going to really be a great shot in the arm for Haines to have that place be a destination.
And you're hoping it'll attract some tourists too, right?
Oh yeah, we're confident that it will. People want to come to Fort Seward, and some people plan their trips to come up here. And with 2017, the sesquicentennial of the purchase of Alaska, and our fort being named after the person who orchestrated that sale, we know that this is going to be a very highly visible project. And we plan on doing a lot of national, international promotion, working with the tourism department and our own PR efforts.
And what's the timeline for the Fort Seward project?
We're aiming for a dedication of the project in the fall, hopefully no later than the Bald Eagle Festival.
What are some things that you've heard from the artists who are signed up to participate in this?
Every one of them is enthusiastic, and it seems that there's this tremendous synergy that's developed. The whole project evolved from trying to redo the Fort Seward interpretive signage, which was simply signage and walking. And when we got the artists all together, the idea of converting the ruined fort into a sculpture garden took off. And it seems like every time we get the group together, another idea pops up and evolves and more enthusiasm spills over. It's great.
Forests are a source of life, of wealth, and inspiration. They can be managed scientifically to ensure that natural and competing uses are balanced or mitigated. Today we're talking with local foresters Roy Josephson and Greg Palmieri about their work and the political forces that shape and threaten Alaska's public forests. Welcome, Roy.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, and welcome, Greg. Glad to see you here
Morning.
Today. Yeah. There's so much to talk about today. And I want to talk about what you do professionally and what your responsibilities are as foresters for the state. And I also want to know more about your thinking behind the proposed timber sale. I think it's still proposed, Baby Brown. And then we want to also touch and dig deep, actually, into the House of Representatives' decision to close your office and basically eliminate your positions. It must be kind of a scary thought to be to dwell on. So here we have two professional positions here in Haines. I think both of you have degrees. People who didn't just come to town and get a job, but you were actually qualified for what it is that the job calls for. And that's a cool thing in town. We really don't have a lot of professional jobs. So tell me, what is it that you do as foresters? And give me a snapshot kind of what activities or projects are right now ongoing in the Haines State Forest right now as we speak.
Our main job, I guess, is managing the Haines State Forest. We also do forest practices or deal with any forestry issues in northern southeast Alaska. And I guess we can get into the governor's proposed budget later, but his proposal was to join northern and southern southeast into one area. And so in that case, we would be kind of managers of all of southeast Alaska as well. Mm-hmm. Things we do, we manage the Haines State Forest. It's a multiple-use state forest. We do forest resources. We do timber sales. We do silviculture management of the second growth stand.
Yeah, how much of that is ongoing right now?
Timber sales?
No, the silver growth management. That seems so lofty somehow.
Yeah, well, most of it's been done in the Kelsaw, where there was lots of logging in the 60s and 70s, and we've done 2,000 acres of pre-commercial thinning and several hundred acres of pruning. We have some pruning contracts ongoing this winter, so... And then we replant everything. You know, most of Southeast has good natural regeneration. We have good natural regeneration, but the Forest Practices Act requires that you get 200 well-established trees within 5 years. And I think that regrowth takes a little longer in Haines, and so we kind of supplement.
Now, wait a minute. Somebody's mandating that so many new trees grow per year? And you have to make that happen no matter what the conditions are?
No, just reestablished. Yeah, yeah, we have to make that happen. Within 5 years, we have to get a second growth. Regeneration is a big part of forestry and logging. You know, mm-hmm. You want to make sure your next crop comes in. And so we supplement the natural regrowth with mm-hmm. seedlings. We collect seed from the state forest. We contract with a nursery down south because there's none in Alaska. They grow us seedlings.
I thought there was one in Palmer. Did there used to be?
There used to be one in Palmer, okay. Yeah.
And what happened? Went out of business?
Yeah, I don't think they had enough business, essentially. And we ask for two-year-old seedlings. They're grown as a plug for a year and then outplanted as a bare root stock because we feel that the brush here is a little more rigorous and we need that bigger seedling to survive. And I think Alaskan nurseries had a hard time producing those plug ones that we get.
So that brings to mind also in talking about the activities that are ongoing, like right now, how many people or businesses or families, I guess you could say, households, are living off of the Haines State Forest right now, in whole or in part? You know, like are the contracts or sales or manufacture or something like that?
Yeah. We have last year we had six different purchasers buying timber sales. So
wow.
Six different businesses selling, you know, either with little sawmills making rough cut lumber, creating log homes, firewood sellers. I don't know if you've seen the show Building Alaska, Tony Malone.
Yes, and, I haven't seen it, but I know about it.
Yeah, and he gets his wood from the state forest. They mill a beam and then turn one side and make mm-hmm. these little cabin kits. So we got, you know, those. And we have several groups or individuals that do the silviculture management that we do thinning and pruning bids, and they do that work for us.
What about foraging? Is there anyone commercially foraging anymore? There used to be, I think, somebody making tea. or something.
Yeah, there was the tea gal, and she did that for several years. There's the you know, the syrup people that did the they did the birch tapping, I think mostly on their own property, but then they also supplemented with some blueberry syrups and things they got from the state forest in the area. So there's a lot of recreation goes on in the state forest. The hill of skiing, some of that's on the state forest, and we get involved in the permitting of that through DNR. I know the borough does a lot of that, and I don't know.
Now the Haines State Forest is 286,000 acres. How much of that is actually forest with trees on it that you manage for whatever uses? I guess it's multiple use, but mostly I guess we think of it as logging, but there's hunting and there's commercial tourism. I don't know, other events, I guess, other activities in there. But how it always intrigued me that the state parks seemed to the parks seen their heyday. You know, we used to have Mosquito Lake Park and, you know, other places around the forest where we had active camping and facilities for tourists, and they don't seem to be as well maintained trails, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the parks are still going. Mosquito Lake Campground is, I believe, it's still being used. Yeah, Chilcoot and Chilcat, of course. You mentioned trails. The Rapinski Trail is mostly on the state forest, and we do some trail work and management of that. In terms of the timber base, there's about 90,000 acres that are considered forest land out of the 286,000 acres. Mm-hmm. And of that, the forest is divided into management units and subunits, and forestry or timber is a priority in several of the units. And then our scenic views or wildlife are the priority in some other units. And so our timber base comes down to about 45,000 acres.
Okay.
That we can actually cut timber on.
So before we get to that cutting of the timber and the Baby Brown timber sale, which is out in the forefront right now, I wanted to talk a little bit about when you manage for multiple use, there's like a couple of layers of economy going on. And I'd like to hear about how do you guys sit in your office and talk about the interplay in the economy of tourism versus timber harvest versus fisheries habitat? Okay, there's that level. And then there's also the idea of, like, are you making producing revenue for the state of Alaska and its general fund, including forestry and other areas, and the economy for Haines itself? Because sometimes I would think that the management issues might be in competition, depending on what your purpose is in your decision. So could you talk a little bit about that? Like, are you only thinking about the state, or are you thinking about the local economy too?
Oh, I think we think about both, you know. I don't know if we really manage economy so much. You know, we certainly timber's on the forefront with us. You know, we try to provide for the demand of the timber forest products. We've got an allowable cut of 5.88 million per year, or 58 million per decade. We do it on a rolling basis, and we're cutting about a tenth of that. I think we've cut like 6 million feet in the last 10 years. So we have a lot of timber that we can cut. And you know, the timber industry boomed in the 60s and 70s, and then there was a little burst in the 90s. Up through mid-90s. And
what caused that burst?
I think markets. Markets is a big deal.
Global.
Yeah, and then since that time, we've mostly been doing these small sales to the little small mills and small operators, I guess. So.
And is it significant revenue to the state? I mean, your stumpage fees is what we're talking about to the state, right? Do you guys make your own... does the revenue from the Haines State Forest support your jobs?
I would say no. I think in 95 we had over $1 million in stumpage that one year, but these small sales, generally it's more about the jobs, I think, and the economies, the local economies. that mm-hmm. are benefits. And so okay. I think that's an important part of small communities is having a variety of economies that...
Did you have something you wanted to add, Greg?
Well, I think that's a really good point. But one thing that we're talking about with the Haines State Forest is the long-term management of a resource for generations to come, and the value to the state and to the local community for responsible management of the state forest over a long period of time is immeasurable. Mm-hmm. And without the ability to do that, I think there's an impact to the community as well. And so everything we do today is based on what the condition of the forest will hopefully be 100 years from now. Our perspective isn't 5 years out, 4 years out this year. Our perspective is long-term, 120 years, 300 years. Mm-hmm. What is the timber going to look like? What is the forest going to look like? What are the resources that are going to be available to the people of the state perpetually should be available on the Haines State Forest that's designated for multiple resource management for the benefit of the people of the state of Alaska?
Now, one of the things that was that your explanation or rationale, I guess, for this Baby Brown timber sale, which is 1,000 acres or 20 million board feet of Sitka spruce and western hemlock, is that the timber is rotting. It's in its most mature state, and so you'd like to see it cut to make room for, or not make room for, but to allow the replanting and the regrowth. But can you talk to me about how you, there was recently a photograph published, you know, in the Chilkat Valley News showing the possible impact of that if it were all cut at once. Certainly you're not insensitive to the visual impact of that. But tell me, I guess, are you somebody that drives by like for 10 miles and sees a clear cut and saying, oh, that's beautiful?
No, I think clear cuts, we kind of base everything on our life spans, our life expectancy. Mm-hmm. You know, we live 80 years, maybe less.
You mean you and me?
Maybe
people?
More.
People? Okay. People. We're talking about general, people now, yeah. Not trees.
Yeah,
okay.
No.
So when the trees are cut, it's kind of a shock to us, you know, in terms of nature, which is going to last thousands of years. It's not as big of an impact, but then, and I'm shocked, I guess, when I see a clear cut the first couple of years, and then it starts to grow back I've been here 30 years now, and I've seen stands that we've cut that were now thinning, and, I'm impressed with the regrowth, and I enjoy seeing that young stand develop.
I want to ask you, I have to admit, I have not been up into the Kelsaw and into these areas where you're doing the silviculture work. Where should I go if I wanted to see what you were doing?
I would drive up the Kelsaw Road. There's a big sign on the right. We've got a timber stand improvement project. Mm-hmm. I think we initially started it in 1982 where we thinned the stand, and then we've done some intermediate, thinned it again, and then we've pruned the trees, and there's a control right next to it, and the sign explains it. Actually, the sign's never been shot, but it some animals have chewed on the corner of it. But
squirrels have been getting at it.
Yeah, but we constructed a trail so you can walk through the control stand and through the thinned and pruned unit. And
And I've taken some school kids through that in some of their classes. It's interesting. You know, mm-hmm. you really can see the difference between an unmanaged and a managed stand, and that's really an example of our silvicultural work.
And how many acres is that have been impacted by your silvicultural work?
Well, we've thinned 2,000 acres. This little TSI plot is 10-acre control.
Yeah, the two units are right side by side, so we can compare them scientifically, and they're both 10 acres exactly the same dimension.
Okay, so now let's go back to the possibility that the Baby Brown timber sale would be sold and harvested within 5 years. Is that that's a possibility? So what would be involved in introducing within 5 years this silvicultural program? And that would be a huge undertaking. I mean, it's easy to, I mean, it's going to sound silly, but it's easy to cut trees. It's not so easy to plant them,
right,
especially in the way that the forest after it's cut is left. I mean, it's usually a jumble of all kinds of slash and stuff.
Right. Well, that's not a negative condition for planting, actually. The trees seem to do well in all the little nooks and crannies that are created, and it's a matter of whether or not the crew that's planting them have the experience and the ability to duck into those spaces. But planting is the first aspect of silvicultural management, and that's what we do following the harvest, hopefully within 3 years of the harvest. If we've got our seed crop out to the nurseries in time, it will be scheduled so that the trees will get replanted, or that crop will get replanted within 3 years of the harvest activity. Mm-hmm. That seems to give our seedlings the best chance. Mm-hmm. Like Roy said, we use the plug one that is a little more hardier seedling that seems to do really well in our region. So that's the first step as far as what we do from a silvicultural mm-hmm. perspective, managing the state forest.
Okay, but I can understand and appreciate that you've trained yourself to be on a 1,000-year schedule. So, you know, as you drive by and you see the sign that says scenic byway, mm-hmm. you know, who is supposed to, and how can the decision to put a timber sale out there be reconciled with a scenic byway designation for a highway?
Well, I think what you're touching on is something that you brought up in an earlier question that we didn't really get to address. You said, how do we deal with all the different mm-hmm. issues in this community in terms of our management? Is there conflict? And I said, there is. There's constantly conflict. There's one side of the coin or the other. And it's interesting because Roy and I do talk about these things constantly because we're responsible for the compromise that most people don't want to reach.
Mm-hmm.
So in considering the multiple resources and the values of the resources, most of the time we make nobody happy. But the reality of the situation...
So the other side of the coin is everybody's happy.
Well,
okay.
If we had that side of the coin, that would be awesome. But the reality of the situation is that we try to put as much science behind what we do and represent the interests of everybody the best we possibly mm-hmm. can.
Mm-hmm.
And we use our experience, which is, I think, the most valuable asset to a mm-hmm. forester. You know, I've been here for 20 years. I've been in forestry since 1990, but I'm, you know, just starting to scratch the surface.
mm-hmm.
A good forester is 60 years. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
then you can really see something happen. But we're seeing stuff happening around here, and it's an important thing. And visuals are important, and we recognize that that's a value that the community has. But one other thing I want to make sure and point out is what that picture in the newspaper represented is not a final product of a clear-cut harvest of that particular timber sale. I think this is a misconception that I want to make sure people understand. Those areas were areas that were specifically taken from our 5-year forest management schedule that is a scoping document that defines areas of potential harvest within our timber base. We were directed to provide a specific area where this type of harvest activity could be offered. And so we drew the sale area boundary around a planning area that we had already identified. So what you're seeing are the large, somewhat vague blocks of areas where we've identified the timber base that could be a component of a timber sale. So what Roy and I, our job is to implement this sale on the ground is to create individual harvest units with all these different concerns that individuals have and the public has, as well as representing the interests of the state, which is to generate revenue. And so to do that, you have to design timber sales that are economically feasible. We don't want to do deficit sales.
So is the baby brown timber sale still somewhat conceptual? It's not...
Very much so.
I see. Okay. So we haven't seen the actual harvest units yet.
Those are not the actual harvest units.
Those are the entire blocks of timber from which harvest units will come.
Roads and units will be designed in the forest land use plan. It's a public document that will come out for review for agencies and obviously the public.
Okay. One of the things, too, I want to critics, I guess, of harvesting timber oftentimes point out that the timber, that the state of Alaska has failed its public by not requiring primary manufacture, and by that, you know, sawmilling or some kind of treatment to the raw log. And so a lot of the interest in the timber sales is for export of our resource to, in the round, to China. So I'll just pick that nation. Mm-hmm. I assume that. Mm-hmm. do you, you know, I'm not asking you to be political because I don't know, it's probably not your job to be political, but what about what would be the impact? What do you think the impact would be if we required primary manufacture? Would that be better for the economy or not?
Well, I don't really think that's the question.
Oh, okay. What is the question?
Well, we got sued because of that very thing in the past, and it's actually comes down to the federal interstate commerce law. We can't make that requirement based on that law. We were challenged, and it went all the way through the courts, and they were told us that, you know, hey, you can't do this.
Yeah, only the federal government can regulate
interstate commerce. They regulate that commerce. We don't. The state does not.
And it has more to do with down south, where one state's next to the other, and you can't say.
Oh.
At the same time, in southern southeast, you know, you got Viking Mill that's already up and functioning. We provide sales to them through a kind of a bidding request for proposal process, where they say how much of your wood is going to be made into value-added products, how much into high value-added, what's our stumpage return, and then they score them. And so we're able to provide the mills in southern southeast with mm-hmm. timber, where the export market's going to give us a much greater dollar return to the state coffers.
Right.
This is, goes to the local mills. And if we had a Haynes mill, if there was a mill here, we could certainly do something like that.
Mm-hmm. In your professional opinion, do you think that the Haynes State Forest could provide, work hand in hand with a high end value industry such as making musical instruments or some other kind of high value manufacture here?
Yeah, we can always sell the high end products. It's just that we don't have that much of it, you know. That's scattered throughout the forest. We've got a lot of low-grade wood. Mm-hmm. And so it's often what makes a sale go is, can you break even on this low-grade wood? Certainly a pellet plant would be ideal. All this biomass, this low-grade mm-hmm. wood.
Mm-hmm. Or some type of biomass facility.
Now, that was being explored, was it not, by CIA? I don't know if it's Chilkoot Indian Association.
But even prior to that, you know, I had gotten involved with the project to provide district heat mm-hmm. through a chip-fired facility to the school and the pool and the downtown administration buildings. And it was a project that went through several different studies all the way to a final economic feasibility study. And the state of Alaska was in support of the project, but we didn't follow through with it. And that's something that could have had the borough, the community. We kind of didn't have the leadership or whatever at the time that was strongly supporting it, and there was a lot of transition in our upper management.
$1.4 million grant?
It was actually a $2.7 million facility that would have been built to provide that. But my point is that we work with the type of industry that you're talking about right now. They purchase, there's millers that purchase high-end product off the state forest to do music wood, for example. It's not a huge market. Mm-hmm. We would work with any entity that was interested in using the wood locally. Professionally, I believe that the resources of the state of Alaska go the farthest when they're managed under a more regional concept mm-hmm. and not exporting all our resources somewhere else. But in order to do that, the community has to facilitate some of that development from a possible manufacturer, for example. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to talk now, spend the last couple of minutes that we have here talking about the threat against the forest here in Haynes. One of the things that I have learned in talking with legislators about the house. It's only the house so far that has actually proposed closing down the Haines office. But there are only three state forests. Not pretty interesting, I think. Yeah. There's a $1.8 million state forest in the interior called the Tanana Valley. And then there's a Haines state forest, 286,000 or 268, whatever. And then there's the Southeast State Forest, which is just a smattering of small holdings down on Prince of Wales Island that's primarily for, as I think we discussed this already, is raising revenue for the state by selling high-grade timber. So really, you know, we are one of two significant state forests. And the House of Representatives has proposed closing it down. Would closing down this office mean closing down the state forest, the Haines State Forest?
No, they would be managed from afar. You know, there would be limited management. I don't know where they would do it from. We think it would probably be done out of Ketchikan. So, you know, they may come up and do the baby brown sale. You know, I don't know how responsive they would be to do small sales.
But what about closing roads and the kinds of things that right now you manage all these other activities
exactly.
in the forest? And I just question it. So I just wanted to put this out here. I want the opportunity to put it out there that Haines might do very well, not just by you gentlemen individually and professionally and personally, but we might do well by the community to invite the state to locate its main office here in Haines. It doesn't make any sense to me to have an office in Juneau. What purpose does having an office in Juneau serve? Can you answer me that?
Well,
obviously, I'm prejudiced against the idea.
No, I think we kind of agree with that. Rather than Juneau, it should be here.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the governor's proposed budget, was to join Ketchikan and Haines in a Southeast State Forest.
Managed from where, though?
Managed from Haines.
From Haines.
Oh,
so
the governor did support that.
Absolutely.
So I would be the area forester for Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would probably end up traveling to Ketchikan a little bit to help the two foresters down there do timber sales. But
And why do you think the House did not think that was such a good idea?
Politics.
Is it politics?
Of course.
From interior or where?
Well, I mean, there's political motivation from all parts of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it can only be taken in the context which was proposed, which is right there in Juneau at that time, you know.
And I think, you know, the AFA's were involved in it, and they're the big timber producers in southern Southeast Alaska. And so
I'm sorry, AFA's
Alaska
Forest Association.
Oh, I see. Okay, who's seated in Ketchikan?
Yeah,
right.
And
but they're mostly primarily interested in the Tongass National Forest. I mean, most of us perceive
right.
Southeast Alaska as the Tongass National Forest. I admit I was surprised to find out there was a thing called the Southeast State Forest.
Well, yeah, many
when did they make that?
Not that long ago.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting. There wasn't even a timber program really to speak of on state forest land. Well, I'm sorry, there was on state land in mm-hmm. Southeast Alaska. Outside of Haines forever.
Right, we're the grandfather of state forests.
Until the mid-1990s, I went down and started an inventory project of those lands for the regional forester. I did that work out of Juneau over two winters, and we identified lands that actually had timber that could be managed.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, there was nobody speaking about creating a state forest down there. And there was no real timber sale program down there at all. And so essentially, he asked me to go down there and initiate that program in terms of a small sale program.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, that has evolved into shifting a focus for the Division of Forestry because of the potential revenue generation was so great down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the timber resources on the Tongass were being limited year by year. And so operators down there were requesting more timber. And under Murkowski, as our governor, he created a bridge timber program specifically focused on our Ketchikan resources.
I see. Okay.
And then following that was the development of the Southern Southeast State Forest.
Okay. Well, we appreciate very much the work that you do. And we're going to have to close this particular discussion out. But I think that the community does value and is very aware of the importance of the state forest to our local economy. And that will be the message. I know the borough has already given that message to the state legislator. Lagers. And anyway, for all of us, we still have work to do to keep you here and keep the forest healthy.
All right.
So I want to thank you very much.
Thanks, Deborah.
Yeah, thanks. And today, from the Meditations of John Muir, this is a reading that was comes from a compilation that was edited by Chris Hyland, and it was published by Wilderness Press in 2001. But this small, short essay was first published in 1938 as a publication called John of the Mountains, the Unpublished Journals of John Muir. And John Muir being a person very much interested in forests and nature, and a man who also has a real strong connection to the very early, not indigenous history, but the very early, let's say, white culture history of the Haines area. This is a very short essay, and it's a snippet, actually, out of a larger one, and it's called Sleeping All Our Lives. It is interesting to note among the passengers the play of quickened action in the minds of those who, brought up in the shadows of city business, have been sleeping all their lives. They gaze at the hills of the coast with curious wonder as if never before had they seen a hill. Objects seen every day are scarce seen at all. Clocks strike without being heard, as one may even hear the discharge of a cannon so often in the same tone and volume of sound that it is no longer heard. So much need is there for change of scene, new points of view. How many notice so glorious a phenomenon as the rising of the sun over a familiar landscape? All that is necessary to make any landscape visible and therefore impressive is to regard it from a new point of view, or from the old one with our heads upside down. Then we behold a new heaven and earth and are born again as if we had gone on a pilgrimage to some far-off holy land and had become new creatures with bodies inverted. The scales fall from our eyes and in like manner we are made to see when we go on excursions into fields and pastures anew. Thanks for joining us today and exploring a bit more deeply some aspects of community life in Haines. Thanks to Tom Morfitt, Carol Tyneman, Reese Williams, Roy Josephson, and Greg Palmieri. This program was produced in the studios of KHNS under the guidance of Margaret Friedenauer, the news director, and her staff, Emily Files. I'm Deborah Schnabel, the volunteer writer and host. Thanks again for joining us today. And if you want to hear this again, KHNS carries it online, Talk Around Town, at khns.org.